Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the H-Span Podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussion. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, we interview Irina and Michael Conboy, professor and faculty at UC Berkeley in their bioengineering division. And Irina is the co-founder of Generation Labs. In this episode, we discuss therapeutic plasma exchange, the recent A4LI DC summit, and how young entrepreneurs and scientists can get involved in the longevity space. Without further ado, here's Irina and Michael Conboy.
Live long and prosper.
Irina and Michael Conboy, thank you both so much for joining the A4LI H-Span podcast. I have been a big fan of both of your work at Berkeley for a long time, and so I'm really excited to not only get this chance to interview you, but also give you some exposure to the A4LI H-Span podcast audience. So thank you both for being here.
Absolutely, and thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Cool. You know, the way I like to start these conversations is I like to dive into the background of my guests and give our audience an understanding of where people come from and how big names in the longevity field get from where they were to where they are. So, Irina, I know you have a very unique background and path to the longevity field. And Michael, you too. Can you both tell us about how you got started being the Conboy power couple that you are?
Yeah, so we started actually, we met at Harvard, and then we started working on scientific approaches to regenerative medicine at Stanford, where we both did our PhD. But we worked in different laboratories and different fields. So I was interested in immunology, and Michael will tell you he was interested in genetics and biochemistry. And then after PhD, we continued with our postdoctoral training at Stanford Medical School, because once you are at Stanford, you pretty much never want to leave. It's such a nice environment and amazing swimming pool and so forth. So then it is at the postdoctoral time when we were focusing on rejuvenation, and we worked in Tom Rando laboratory looking at how to make old muscle to become young. And then we co-published a paper in Science in 2003, moving field forward, saying that even if the mouse is old and the muscle doesn't work anymore and is unhealthy, just changing signaling pathways pharmacologically will make old muscle young again. So then Mike can weigh in.
That pretty much sums it up. I'm surprised. I've been hearing this occasionally, that people call us big people in the molecular aging field, and we don't think of ourselves as big people and remember when we were little people.
I think of you guys as big people in the longevity field. It's always weird to hear people say that, though, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, you did short the industry.
Stint, yeah, as a postdoc.
Stint, yeah.
Yeah, but then I was doing something that had to do with, again, genetics and cell biology. I'd come home at night, and Irina would come home at night. And what did you do today, dear? And Irina's work was getting to be so much more interesting than anything I was doing. She had been interested in aging since a very young age.
Yes,
and,
it sounds
and
fun.
Pursuing that, and again, and like she said, in Tom Rando's lab, finding out what is it. At the time, stem cells were becoming big. This was before the ISSCR and before the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine stem cell thing. Irina was studying the stem cells in mice and saying what happens with those cells with age. That was fascinating. And still is.
Yeah. So. And then you dropped out of your industry postdoc and joined the same lab as me.
I did, yeah. We both knew Tom Rando and talked with him and suggested that if I joined, I could solve some technical issues that you're having with the project to make things move a little easier and get better data. And he knew me. And so he said, sure, join. And that was a great lab to do a postdoc in.
This was a great lab. It was at the time very small and not famous lab at all.
Let me ask you this, Michael. Did you want to join the lab for the science, or was it for Irina?
Of course, the science.
Oh, all right. I was trying to give you a layup there.
We were already married.
You're already married.
I had Irina in the morning and night. So
now you got her for the day, too. Perfect. Perfect.
24/7.
That's beautiful.
Continued from then on. So then in 2005, we published this famous Nature paper on suturing yangs together. And it would not have been possible if we were not working together on the project. And then we started our laboratory at UC Berkeley, which is now, this year is the 20th year anniversary of our lab.
Wow. I did not know that. Congratulations to you both. Yeah, you both are institutions at UC Berkeley now. So do you ever miss Stanford, or am I not allowed to ask that question because you guys are at Berkeley?
It's okay to be at Berkeley and still miss Stanford.
Okay, all right.
But honestly, I have been back to Stanford since, and it's changed a little bit. It's less and less farm every day and more
I definitely miss Stanford of
parking. Yeah.
2000s, early 2000s, where you could see foxes in the parking lot and it was not so overbuilt, like
Interesting.
wild nature. And all of the scientists lived in the garages of wealthy people because that's the only thing we could afford. So I miss that one. But then right now, I hardly recognize Palo Alto or Stanford anymore of our graduate
Right.
times.
Yeah.
So I don't miss it, no.
Fascinating. Fascinating backgrounds. I think our audience will smile when they hear the story. There's a few things I want to actually ask you about some recent work, but we'll get into that later. Can you both, so obviously you're both professors at UC Berkeley and you've spun out Generation Labs as well. So can you talk?
Like only me.
Only Irina. Okay.
Irina's a professor. I'm not a professor. I'm a scientist. The title is a scientist. And I am actually not officially associated with Generation Labs.
Okay.
So that's Irina's baby.
All right. All right. Then I'll ask this question to Irina only then.
Yeah, just a sec, Dylan. So it is fair to say that we both are faculty at UC Berkeley.
Faculty.
So
Got
my also has title of faculty, but I am professor and co-founder of Generation Lab.
Are you, Irina, are you a fair grader as a professor?
Fair grader. Yes, I'm very fair grader. In fact, we have this rule. So it's not just me, but all of the graduate student instructors, we grade together and in a blended fashion from each other. And then the grade is the average of our evaluation.
Okay,
So it's
interesting.
not just like me, it's many people together.
I like that system. I like that system. So I guess, Irina, this question will be just for you. Can you talk about some of the work at your lab at UC Berkeley, and then also some of the work that you're doing with Alina at Generation Labs?
Yes, I think one of the most exciting discoveries of the Canberra lab for the past 2 years was a new way to figure out what is the natural cure for biological aging. Now, chronological aging is easy. It's pretty much you look at the calendar and you look at your driver's license and you know your chronological age, and it progresses very linearly, completely linear. But biological aging is not the same. It is pretty much the degree of decline in your health, and not just in your overall health, but health of your tissues, organs, cells, and molecules over that calendar span of how long you live. So you could be 70 years old, but biologically much younger, or you could be 40 and biologically much older. So what happens is that we don't have a very good way to quantify biological age. We have excellent way to quantify chronological age. And there is age clocks, for example, Horvath clock, Fino age, they have many different names. But what they are claiming is that if you simply linearly approximate progression from the first point to the last point, that's good enough. That's how we can predict your biological age. And what we then said, knowing epigenetics and genetics and biology, is that it doesn't seem to be accurate, that biological aging is not linear. And by making it linear artificially, you might skip very important transition points of loss of health or recovery of health. So then the question was, what is the actual curve? How do we physically go biologically from being young to becoming old? And we decided to look at the genes in our genome, in our blueprint, that are so vital for us that we try to keep their levels the same from the time we are young to the time we are old. It's metaphorically speaking that you always have heartbeat. You start your heartbeat even before you are born, and you continue the heartbeat, which is pretty much similar throughout your life. And if something is wrong with that, if it becomes irregular, you know you are in trouble.
We call them housekeeping genes.
And we call them housekeeping genes.
Right.
Exactly, housekeeping genes. So instead of looking at something that becomes bigger with age or smaller with age, we try to identify every single piece of the quantifiable epigenome that is the same, that does not become bigger or smaller. And so we found 460 roughly such areas out of 500,000, out of 500,000. And then when we looked at them and looked at what happens to their fluctuation, do they really are the same or they're slightly different in people who are 30 versus people who are 40, 60, and 90, we noticed that the noise of the genes becomes larger with age. So the mean levels are the same. But in young people, they are all the same mean levels. And then mean levels differences increase, the noise increases. And then basically that direct quantification of the noise then formed the pattern of human biological aging, which could be used to predict risk of disease before there are any symptoms. And so then Alina Hsu and Michael Saswell decided to co-found Generation Lab and offer this opportunity to people to then test the level of their biological noise, and not just for overall body, but for different functions, for cardiovascular system, lungs, regeneration, reproduction, and so forth. And therefore, the advantage is that, first of all, it's not a prediction, it's quantification from real primary results. And the second one, that we see dysregulation of your systems, of your organism, before you have any symptoms and before you can detect that anything is wrong by any clinical tests. So that was the first product of Generation Lab that is actually doing quite successfully right now.
And so two things come to my mind. The first thing is you talked about how biological aging isn't linear. And there was a paper that came out maybe 6 months ago. I forget who exactly authored it, but they basically said that there are two major flashpoints when it comes to aging. I think it was like 44 and 60 something, 62 maybe. Do you have any thoughts on that analysis?
Yeah, so there are actually two papers, and now more and more studies are coming out which confirm what we have always known, right? So it was never a secret for anybody that biological aging is not linear, right? That you do not have one gray hair per day, and that's how you eventually have a head of gray hair, right? Everybody knew that is not the case. Then what was done in these papers, and they were published approximately a year or 2 years after our discovery, is that if you catalog typical clinical tests, like you go to your primary care and you do physical exam. And then in this physical exam, your cholesterol, body mass index, blood pressure, and various other metrics, C-reactive protein. And if you catalog them all, you pretty much discover what we phenotypically know simply by looking at people. But first, they're healthy and young. Then we lose our fitness and our health a little bit, but we still have a plateau of healthy adulthood. And then around menopause or andropause, we shift from that healthy plateau and start developing problems. So phenotypically, we know that, and it is great that this paper also showed the same by cataloging non-clinical tests. But mechanistically or like intervention-wise, it is the paper from the Kanbo laboratory, first author, who discovered these inflection points or transition points from more health to less health and from plateau to living plateau, mechanistically based on epigenetics.
Interesting. And so the second question I had was, so you mentioned that the test was Generation Lab's first product. You looking at, as a company, to create therapeutics to then affect the biological age test that the tests, or the biological age results that the tests show? Are you still
Yes.
promoting interventions?
Yeah. So actually, and that's why Alina is a great business person. I have never seen her. I have never met her equal, seriously. Because I thought that for a while we'll just try to optimize the test itself. There is a lot of things which we can do better, and then we will make it less costly. But Alina is no Arina. Everybody wants you to discover longevity therapeutic. All know you as the mother of longevity. They want you to discover something. And so then eventually, and she was very insistent. And so right now, yes, we have a three generation product which are candidate longevity therapeutics, and we hope to basically make them available to people this year. Likely it will be through clinical trials this year, if everything goes well. Absolutely.
Wow.
That is the goal.
This year. So available. So are you entering, you're entering clinical trials this year, or how are you going to make it available this year?
We are coordinating clinical trials. We have clinical trial director. We already have a very good plan for clinical trial. We are in later stages, what I would call R&D, and the patent should be published on these products within a year and a half. So patents are usually become public after 18 months of
Wow.
submission.
Awesome. I'm excited. I could probably use some of that myself these days. Let me know when the clinical trial starts.
I don't know, Dylan, about you. Maybe you're dead,
Maybe.
but definitely neither me nor Mike enrolled in any therapeutic plasma exchange trials. But for generation compounds, generation 1 to 3, yes, I hope to join clinical trial as a participant.
Awesome. Awesome. See, that's the beautiful part of designing the clinical trials. You can just hop in if you want. That's perfect. So I have a question about a recent paper that came out, I think, 2 days ago out of the Buck Institute. They found that therapeutic plasma exchange, I think, reduced biological age by 2 or 3 years. So I just want to get your general thoughts on that paper, both of you, Michael and Irina. Do you have thoughts on the results there? Do you see more significant, less significant results in studies that you run, just in general?
Mike will probably be a better person to discuss this in more detail because he did journal club on that, quality research group. I can just tell you, like, have a, in the way of introduction, that this is the third paper on the rejuvenation through therapeutic plasma exchange. First one was published from the Canpo Laboratory in 2020, and Dobry Kiprov, who is the main person behind the recent paper, is one of the co-authors. And that first paper tells that therapeutic plasma exchange is rejuvenative in mice and in people. The second paper was focused only on people. It also came from the Canpo lab in 2022 and also shows reduction of bulk. And so then this is the third paper on this topic, which in some ways make it important that there is a good traction with this approach. And on the other hand, I don't think then is super innovative, but not everything should be innovative, right? Clinical approaches need to be repeated again and again, and that is their significance. And then there is a big negative in the methodology, in my opinion. Michael can tell more about that. And it is the timing. When do they test what happened with the plasma exchange?
Yeah, Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's some good that comes out of that paper. They did another study of therapeutic plasma exchange. They did have a sham control, which was an improvement over the previous studies. My critique about it would be that the big comparison that they did was between, first, explain what they did, right? So the patient goes in, they have their blood, their old blood, that might have in our model that there's a sort of an increase or accumulation of things, factors that are floating around the blood that kind of controls oldness, let's say, generally. So then they go to and they get hooked up to the therapeutic plasma exchange machine. Their blood goes into the machine. The red blood cells come back, the white blood cells come back, the platelets come back. The plasma, which contains a lot of these soluble factors that we think control oldness, that gets thrown away into a bag. And re to replace that, drips, 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 saline with the major protein that's in the plasma, which is called albumin. All right. So you can imagine that after a procedure of this, there's much less factors of all kinds in the blood because my model is like a fishbowl, right? So the fishbowl is all murky and disgusting, and you throw the water away and you put in fresh water, and now it's all nice and clean, and the fish perks up. So what they were describing as rejuvenation was comparing the blood before this procedure to the blood very soon after this procedure. If you look at the timing when they did this, they would do a procedure and then 2 days later they would do another procedure. And just before that second procedure, that's when they would collect the second sample of blood, right? And a month could go by, and they would do this again, right? But again, it's the sample that they're taking is just a day or two after one of these procedures. So of course, there's going to be huge differences in the amount of. They looked at metabolites, they looked at proteins, and they also look at the epigenetic signatures of the white blood cells that they found, right? And of course, all that's going to change dramatically because they've changed the blood. They've simply diluted it so much, right, dramatically. And if you look at what they found was largely levels of everything going down. Of course, it went down because they threw away all the analytes that they were going to look at.
Okay.
So I have trouble concluding a whole lot from that. They also, part of that study, they did a longer term where every month they would do a procedure and they would take a blood sample before doing the procedure a month apart. That would be more interesting because that gives the body a month to recover from the acute procedure. And now, what's the new steady state? Is it a younger steady state? Is it an older steady state? I think that I'm sure they have that data. That might be the paper that I'm more interested in because it's not just, when you change oil in your car, if you did an oil test on it, it looks great. When you change the water in your fish tank, you put the test strips in there, it looks great. You clean your house, you can take the white glove out, you wipe it on things, there's no dust on the glove. But let it sit a month and then see what happens. Are you keeping a better house? Are you feeding the fish too much? Have you been driving your car like a maniac and it's all burnt up oil? So that's the idea from that
So
paper.
do you have any sort of sense of the frequency in which you would need to get therapeutic plasma exchange, or is there any the evidence or data about that out there?
Yes, there is. So in our paper that Dobry Kiprov was a co-author, he gave us samples for 2020, 21, 22 studies, came from his clinic as well. So we studied what happens about 1 month after the procedure, and there was very promising results, such as that the blood proteome is stably younger for people after this procedure. The noise of the systemic proteins, we discussed that noise is the biomarker of natural aging, is diminished. And senescent cells and DNA damaged cells circulating in blood become less prevalent. So that was super interesting. However, there are many papers published not by us, but by people who just do this procedure regularly, saying that all of the factors that you are throwing away with the discarded plasma come back in about a couple of weeks. So that should give us an idea of how often one would need to repeat the procedure. We also noticed in our studies that you only need to do this procedure two times, two to three times, and then if you do it more, it doesn't matter. You don't have additional improvements.
So it plateaus, or does it have any negative effect if you continue to do it?
I think it is expensive, so people were paying back then, I think, around $4,000 per procedure. Now it's between six and ten. So maximum we looked at, I think, was five or six times then people did this procedure, and it was roughly plateauing. But we don't know. No, the procedure itself, therapeutic plasma exchange, was in clinic for over 30 years. So the safety regimens and effectiveness for various diseases are very well known. So
Right.
safety is clearly well known. But my overall kind of question would be, if you are measuring what happens 2 days after any procedure, how can you say that you are younger or older rather than that it's just an acute effect of huge blood loss and replacement with saline and albumin?
I think that's one of the big questions in our field here right now is, are these temporary fixes, or is this truly something that's reversing our aging in a long-term fashion? So I think that's something where the field needs to coalesce and raise understanding around that. But anyways, what were you gonna say?
The twice a week regimen that they used, that is interesting. Instead of the previous data that we had where it was someone did it every month and some people took 2 or 3 months before they reached their plateau, maybe they have some information now because instead of waiting so long, if you just go boom a couple of days apart, does that get you to the same plateau? But now it only took a week. But that data isn't in that paper. Hopefully they have those samples and they're looking at that data and maybe we'll find out in the next paper or so. The other thing is, like Irina said, it gets to a plateau without any further intervention. When does that plateau change? Is it a month later? Is it several months later? Is it a year later? Who knows?
And then finally, another thing, Dylan, that I think is important for our field is that not every change can be characterized as rejuvenation. Yeah, you will have a change because what Michael was saying, you threw away inflammatory cytokines which are elevated in old people. Is it rejuvenation? No, you just simply threw them away and you can measure it, but it's up to us to semantically call them.
It's not necessarily, yeah, I get what you're saying. It's not rejuvenating your systems and your organs and your cells. It's just removing something that makes them age more rapidly, potentially, which is.
Or it's removing the very transient marker of aging. It's flies of a butterfly and flies, sorry, wings of the butterfly and wings of a bird. That yes, there are more inflammatory cytokines typically in some old people. And there is also more inflammatory cytokines in the young people who are not healthy. We say it's aging.
Okay.
And once you remove them, you can say that there is less of them because I just threw them with a bag. But you cannot really say that your entire system is now younger, that your organism is younger, that you are younger genetically and epigenetically, and with respect to all of the intricate crosstalks between the cells in your body.
I wonder how I'm doing. Maybe I should go get a test. I don't know. Interesting. Okay. That was all fascinating. And you actually helped me understand not only this paper, but plasma therapeutic exchange better. I want to shift focus to some of the things that we did in the past month, Irina. You came and you spoke wonderfully at the A4LI Summit, and then you went on a little bit of a tour around the Capitol buildings to meet with some members of Congress. I want to first ask you about those interactions you had with congressional offices. You went with, I believe, Michael and I'm forgetting who you went with. A
Don Bacon. So Don Bacon was the very first representative and his staff. And then what was her name? I
Latifah
forgot.
Simon.
Yes. And then another congressman from California who I liked her staff actually the best. They were the most engaged. But I can tell you afterward, Dylan, because I took photographs at the doors of every representative. So, so it was me and Michael's as well. It was really my very first meeting session of the type of this kind. And thank you so much. It was really amazing experience.
I appreciate you coming out. This isn't a one-off thing, Irina. I'm hoping we can get you or Michael or someone from the lab or Generation Lab to come back out for next year because, you know, this
I'm
is
looking forward to that. Please count me in because
awesome.
I pretty much felt very patriotic all the time. It was like the influx of healthy patriotism during these meetings everywhere, right? Michael Saswell and me, we took many photographs and I truly enjoyed it. And it was unforgettable experience. Thanks to you and your foundation.
I'm using that as a sizzler for next year, Irina. You're gonna be on our promo clip, all right?
Absolutely. You can, you are recording it. So yeah, so feel free.
A4LI is Irina approved. So we're getting the thumbs up from Irina.
Was unforgettable experience. It is not just approved. It was truly unforgettable experience that I'm looking forward to repeat if you guys have other events.
You're giving me marketing gold here, Irina. I appreciate it. So can you, what I'm interested in asking you about is some of the conversations you had. You mentioned some were better than others. You talked to Democrats and Republicans. Can you maybe talk about some of the talking points that you gave out to these offices and what you think resonated, what you think didn't? Yeah, if you can just go into that, would be great.
First of all, it was a very good unifying theme that everybody agreed that it is a bipartisan issue that people can coalesce around that need to promote longevity caucus, to join longevity caucus, and that it is totally worthy endeavor. Then there was a little bit of a difference with respect to whether we should say MAHA or not should say MAHA. So Make America Healthy Again, I thought it is really non-controversial, but somehow I guess it maybe semantically remains somewhat trigger word or
Well,
sentence.
improving health span would be
Yes.
the first step towards longevity.
I don't make it, I don't like I make America healthy again, yes, but I want to make America healthier than ever. Because
Yes,
you know
exactly.
what's again? We're gonna go back to the 1960s when we were living till 63 or 65 or whatever,
Exactly.
right? So we should be healthier than ever. But anyways, yes.
Actually, very good. Healthier than. And then everybody were taking notes. So the staffers, we met with actual very influential staffers, either chief of staff or the, what was the other appointment?
Legislative director.
Exactly, director, political committee director, or some sort of that, or a staffer who was responsible for the health and longevity programs, that congressperson. And they took notes and they totally agreed with us that we need to ensure that there is sufficient funding for both fundamental and translational longevity and aging research. So that resonated very well. And then another point that was accepted very well is that right now we are in this kind of precipice where the wheels of science could stall or go backward, or we can move them forward to meaningful interventions for currently incurable diseases that people just assume are incurable, such as Alzheimer's disease or osteoporosis or increasing frailty, loss of independence with age. So we were able to convince the staffers of the Congress, men and women, that it is not that it could be done anytime. Right now, it is the opportune time
We're doing it.
for doing it. We are doing it.
Absolutely. And that's why I started the organization, right? To work with the government. This is the most important aspect of society, right? And ensuring that patients and all of us remain as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And it's up to the government to be a major player in that whole thing. And I will say also, it's looking, I'm not going to give numbers just yet, but it's looking like we will add a significant amount of members of Congress to the caucus. And I want to thank you, Irina, and I want to thank everybody who participated because without everybody's participation, we would not be where we're about to be. I appreciate that.
That's really good to hear. Because another thing that I was specifically mentioning, maintaining this positive attitude, is that sometimes it's hard to tell if clinical trials are successful or are failing. Because what is the failure of a clinical trial? Show that something works in rodents, in mice. And then we show that it does not yet work in humans. We at the same time start understanding why, how to make it work in humans. So the point that you probably already got, Dylan, from the questions I was asking at the DC symposium, at DC longevity meeting, is that we should not be afraid of presenting negative results because there is no such thing as negative result. It is simply that we understood the problem. And there should be finding to understand the problem and therefore to find the solution. Right now, when there is not enough finding, period, there is a tremendous pressure to say that everything worked. And that becomes just
Absolutely.
unrealistic.
And then data is manipulated,
That
and
cannot
then people put funds towards things that don't work,
work.
which
Exactly. And as a default, we put funds toward things that turn out not to work. And it was not like anything malicious. It was an honest mistake under tremendous pressure of limited funding.
I remember when I first met both of you, I think 3 years ago, that's actually something we spoke about in depth. And I agree with you 100%. Negative results are not, they're positive in the sense that now we have more information about what may work and what doesn't work, and we can allocate funds and funding appropriate with just more information. So I'm totally with you.
A scientific method often works best ruling out a theory, ruling out a positive. The theory can't work because we did the study, we did it well, and this is the data, and it shows that it's not supported.
Yeah,
Exactly.
it's super important for everybody. We have an army of talented young people who then they're wasting their precious time in the graduate school by pursuing some track that might not be successful. If and there is constant noise of this worked and this is great and this is even better, yet then clinical trials do not show the efficacy and we say it's failure. I think that goes this balance into one direction of everything is great to another direction it's a failure. And the truth is someplace in between. Prudency tells us it's someplace in between. And if there was enough funding, we would just move much faster towards the truth.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. And that's actually, that was one of so we wrote our NILAR paper last year, which focuses on creating what our idea of a National Institute for Longevity and Aging Research, that's NILAR, that's the acronym, at the NIH. And one of the key pillars of that paper, of that institute, is the encouragement to publish and share failing clinical trial results and failing studies. And exactly for the reasons that you said, right? We need more data, and we need to be able to allocate funding appropriately based on that, not manipulated results.
They are not really manipulated. What I would say is that they are skewed, and they are not even skewed because of the researchers' biases. They are skewed because of the funding bias.
Right.
Researchers do their best, but the results become skewed because many other results, which said that it doesn't work, were rejected at the level of the editors and not even sent for peer review.
Absolutely. Cool. All right. I have a few more questions for you, but they're not, so I'm going to just switch topics a little bit, and I'm going to ask you both some sort of general questions about where you see the field moving and some advice you might have for young people getting into the field. So the first question I have for you is, where do you see the longevity field a year from now, 5 years from now, and in a decade from now? Do you see significant progress? This might be a loaded question, but I like to see if I can get some hot takes from my guests.
We know what's on our publication track, right? Things that are either under submitted, under review, under revision, or in press. And I imagine a lot of other our colleagues are in the same situation. I would say the next year is going to be exciting and interesting. I would hope in the next 5 years, we'll see more of development, such as we've seen with, let's say, the therapeutic plasma exchange, with
Pharmacology.
the pharmacological intervention, with like the metformin and the rapamycin, things like it along that way. Maybe that, and same thing with the therapeutic plasma exchange. Maybe each of these is not for everybody, but we start getting them out there and start people thinking about them. Who, what age, what condition are these going to help extend health span? Right. So I would think in the next 5 years, what the field has been doing for the past 10, 15 is going to start getting translated into, I would hope, get it translated into real therapies for people.
And what Mike was saying is that let's say that we cannot extend lifespan or health span yet for everybody, so everybody live until they are 120 or 140 healthier. But it is possible that we will be able to help those who are already on the brink of developing neurodegeneration or arthritis, and now they do not develop those diseases for a few decades. That might be the first kind of classification of the population groups of people who our research can help in the next year or 5 years.
Beautiful. And then 10 years, what do you think? I know that's pretty far out.
You talk with like
Yeah.
people that are more visionary than me. I think an Harvard degree is one of them. I would hope that in 10 years we start getting some idea on how to break out of the limited human lifespan, health span, which say some say are what, 120 years, something like that, and start getting into, say, how can we extend that indefinitely? So that, I think, in the next 10 years would be great if we did that, right?
Yeah, but
It
that's
might take another 20 years past that to actually start seeing it implemented, but at least a glimpse of how to do it,
how to
right?
beautiful.
will involve, real digital interface. So you are not completely made out of carbon chains. You are actually somewhat
Where I become my
simulated,
AI.
right?
I become my own AI.
You become your own AI or things of that nature, I think will become more concrete in 10 years. And with respect to maintaining and improving the health of our bodies, what I hope to accomplish in the next 10 years and through Congo Lab and Generation Lab is to start, rational rejuvenation. So while chronological age or the clock or calendar move forward, you don't, you stop. And we have very interesting work in progress in that direction. That is one of the papers which we hope to publish this year.
You're getting me excited. You're getting me
So
excited. It's a great time to get in the field. Would you agree with that? Because I feel like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was a little too nascent and a little bit underdeveloped. And now we are at the point where there are hundreds of biotechs and dozens of labs at prestigious universities, and we're starting to get the government involved. And so my last question to you guys is, there are young people listening to this podcast that are interested in making a name for themselves in the longevity field, being involved, participating, and helping. What's your advice to those young people that are looking to get involved?
our advice, I think, is always the same to all scientists young people who go into longevity sphere or any other sphere, is take care of science and science will take care of you.
I
And
love
what
it.
that means is that you do not get distracted by, oh, this is my competitor published this or that, or should I reference this previous paper or not? What can I do career-wise? Should I criticize somebody? Because maybe if I criticize somebody, I cannot find a job. No, that is not a good approach at all.
I don't want to study fruit flies because they're not immediately relevant to human disease.
Exactly.
Right?
Who wants to study fruit flies?
Right.
Stuff like that.
Study fruit flies so you can learn to be a scientist.
So just find something that is super interesting to you and then ask a novel question that answering this question either yes or no will be a scientific breakthrough and go for it.
That's beautiful. It's beautiful. Do you agree with that, Michael?
Wholeheartedly. Yep.
Beautiful. I think part of the work at A4LI is to obviously interface with government, but it's also to build a bit of a social movement around that, right? Because they go hand in hand. And so getting young, passionate, next generation scientists involved in not only the science, but also the advocacy work, I think will accelerate this timeline significantly. So I appreciate that advice, and I think our listeners will as well. Final question for you both. When you get out of bed in the morning, What gives you hope about the future of humanity? There's a lot of things right now that are scary or uncertain, but I try to wake up every day and be thankful for the things in my life that I'm thankful for and have an optimistic outlook for the future. So what gives you hope when you get out of bed in the morning and you start your day?
I don't know. So I'm just thinking this is very unusual kind of question because literally speaking, when I get up in the morning, I go to the beautiful garden and orchard that Michael and I have behind our house, and we have chickens and bees, and that kind
Okay.
of reduces the stress and gives me hope about structure of the universe. I do not really focus on bad things or good things in the humanity per se, but just like the harmony. I try to focus on the overall harmony and beauty around me. If I start thinking about it, Dylan, seriously, it's like people like your dad and you that give me hope about humanity. Because none of you, neither you nor your dad's friends, have to do what you are doing. It is totally self-motivated and self-driven to help the progress of our humanity together, so that you are helping us and you are relying on our help, reciprocal to you. And that's what, if I start thinking about it, what gives me hope in humanity is that people who don't have to do good things are still doing them.
You're giving me the best sizzle. These are the best, Irina. You're going to give me so many sizzlers for all of the things that we're putting out. This is great.
That is true, right? Because I'm typically very critical, as you probably guessed, conference, the DC meeting, and I do not. So it's absolutely sincere. Yeah.
I appreciate that, Irina. Seriously, thank you. Michael, do you have any final comments on that?
But that again, it's something that that doesn't really bother me when I get out of the morning, bed in the morning more. It's some cat meowing for food. But not everyone's going to be a scientist. So an advice of take care of the science will take care of you. That works great for younger people that want to be scientists, but not everybody wants to be a scientist. Some people want to do business. Some people want to do art. Some people want to. But if you're interested in the longevity and the field, you're looking at your own future, right? Where are you going to be when you're living longer and healthier? So maybe have that perspective when I get out of bed in the morning, is don't think about your future and try not to mess up the world.
That's also great advice. That's also great
We're
advice.
going to be living a long time in it, right? So.
Take care of the world around you because we're going to be here for a long time. I remember I listened, I'm not going to name the name, but I listened to an appointee of one of the past administrations. He was going for attorney general, and they were digging into his background. And he said, I'm not going to be here in 10 years. So why does any of this matter to me? And I think if we obviously living healthier and longer is a good thing for the individual, but I think it's also a good thing for society because long-term thinking usually yields more compassionate and well-thought-out plans. So I totally agree with you, Michael. I think the perspective that we can take in this new longevity world will not only benefit the individuals, but will benefit social interactions, will benefit politics, will benefit society as a whole. And so I wholeheartedly agree. All right, guys, this was a great conversation. I'm so honored that you could make time for the H-Span podcast. And thank you both. Last thing, is there any way that our audience can find you, follow your work? Do you have any websites you want to give a shout out to, Twitter feeds, anything like that?
So we have Convo Lab website. It's super easy to find. Just go to Google and Google Convo Lab, and it's the first thing that you see. We are super easy to find on Berkeley, University of California directory. Just enter our names. And then Generation Lab has a wonderful website also. So please get in touch with us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I encourage you all to do. All right. Thank you, Irina and Michael, so much for coming. And we'll be back with another H-Span podcast episode soon.
Great.
Great.
Thank you. Bye. Yeah.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Irina and Michael, for joining us today on the H-Span podcast. And thank you to all of our listeners at home. I hope you found this conversation as enlightening and informative as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, please send your suggestions to us at info@a4li.org. H-Span will be back in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.